I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A year ago, President Obama said he'd be freed up to get things done during his second term because he wouldn't have to worry about re-election. It hasn't worked out that way. His administration has had to deal with allegations about a politicized IRS, revelations about the NSA tracking foreign leaders and the public in this country and abroad, a sloppy rollout of the healthcare website, a government shutdown, and declining support. So what does this say about Obama's presidency, the Democratic Party, the GOP, and the country's political system? We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a book most recently, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He joins us from the studios of Princeton University. And Julian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Margaret Tolliver. She's White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. And Margaret, nice to have you back with us as well.
Marty, it's great to be here. And hello, Professor.
Hi.
Well, let us begin here. And Margaret, since you're down there in Washington, how much has this troubled website for the health care, the Affordable Care Act, how much has that hurt the president?
It is, at a best-case scenario, a thorn in his side and has undercut the momentum that he hoped to have between now and the end of the year, building up to the actual start of the January 1st coverage. In a worst-case scenario, depending on how the next several weeks go, depending on their ability to actually fix this thing and get it up and running, it could seriously drag down what is essentially his only kind of unique proactive major policy agenda. I mean, of course, things like the stimulus or saving the economy from the precipice of another depression, that's kind of like, that's dealing with something that got thrown in your lap. This is the only major initiative that he kind of came up with, crafted, pushed through, and the notion that that it may be a thorn in his side is something they are really, really trying to prevent, you know, from happening.
And I want to go back to you, but Julian, let me get you in on the conversation. And I'm thinking about the troubled rollout of the Medicare Part D. Even Medicare itself had a troubled rollout. Is this one even worse?
Well, you know, Medicare had problems during the rollout, but within a year it was operating and it was pretty functional. This has already been delayed. We have to remember this program passed several years ago already. So it's not as if the implementation started right after the passage. So we're already a long time from the battles in Congress. And now to have this as an added layer of problem for the administration, I think makes it a little different than Medicare. A few years out, Medicare was providing benefits to a huge number of seniors. Right now, this program isn't. So that is a problem. It's also a complicated program. Medicare provided hospital insurance for the elderly. This is more of a, you know, jerry-built regulatory mechanism to bring people into the insurance system. So it's not as satisfactory to many Americans. So I think the problems in some ways are bigger.
But, Julian, as we know, Kathleen Sebelius and the president basically said by the end of November this will be up and running. Of course, time will tell whether that will work or not. But if it is up and running, does that sort of negate everything that we just said?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of questions with this program, whether all the Republican states are going to include the Medicaid expansion. There's still many holdouts, and that's really critical. Will premiums eventually come down as promised? If it doesn't, I think there's going to be a lot of unhappiness with the program, and many Americans still won't be insured. So it's not a complete solution, and I think the administration is aware there's still vulnerabilities, and the website is only really part of making this all work.
And Margaret, are other Democrats worried about what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act and this particular website rollout?
To some extent they are. There's a real question about whether this is going to become a factor in the 2014 midterms, particularly for some Democrats running for Senate seats. You know, to go back to what Julian just said, I do think that ultimately he will be judged and his legacy will be judged on how well the program works, whether people who couldn't get coverage before get coverage, whether on balance it makes the insurance system stronger. And these are things that will take, you know, years to play out. The problem for the president is that he's got 3 years left and really 1 year left, right, to make a push for anything. So I think the long view is that this is sort of a side debate, this website launch and whether it affects midterm elections and the stakes for Democrats. It's not really the point in terms mm-hmm. of how strong is America, how healthy are Americans, can people who didn't used to be able to get coverage get it? That's got nothing to do with this, really. But in the short term, when you're running for office, like it's only as good as between now and the next election, right? And that's and so this is really, it is a side issue to the policy debate, but a very real issue politically right now.
And we're talking about, if we're talking about the website, Margaret, we're talking about a website that applies to about 15% of the population that either don't have insurance or get it on as an individual plan.
Yes. I mean, the issue is this. Look, with the website, with the phone, however you sign up, this affects different waves of millions of Americans, right? There's like Americans who have insurance, but they can't keep their insurance, and they're a small set. There's Americans who may be able to get better insurance than they could get, may be able to get it cheaper, may be able to get it subsidized. There's Americans who may be forced to get insurance, who didn't want insurance. There's all these different subgroups, and again, whether they can register through the website or by phone or how long they have to wait, these are fairly short-term issues, even if it takes a while to get the kinks worked out on the website. These are not long-term issues, but in sort of political dog years, they're
political dog years,
really,
right?
Time, right? You know?
Yeah. Julian, let me quote something that you wrote. Actually, you wrote yesterday for CNN. You said the Affordable Care Act was a product of a kind of half-baked liberalism that has been popular among many Democrats for several decades. Now, expand on your idea there.
Well, you just compare the health care proposal that President Obama put forward with what we've had in previous decades, whether we're talking about Medicare, which is essentially a, you know, single-payer program for the elderly, or proposals that were very much alive in the 70s and 80s and even into the early 90s when Democrats were pushing for some kind of government-centered insurance program to solve this problem of the uninsured. Now we pick something very different. It's really a program that builds out of the Massachusetts model from Mitt Romney. It's a very complex system where essentially healthy people are being brought into the private insurance system with the hope of lowering costs. And there's all kinds of complicated regulatory mechanisms that are essential to making this work. And I think it's hard on two levels. First, it's just not very easy for people to understand. And in politics, ease does matter. There's not a tangible benefit for many middle-class Americans that's apparent right now. And second, as we're seeing, there's a million ways to subvert the bill, to subvert the program when it's this complex. And I think Republicans are taking advantage of that.
But, Julian, are you saying that a Medicare for all type health care program could have gotten through Congress a couple of years ago?
Well, we don't know. I mean, the argument of pragmatism is always this was the best solution possible. But we have to remember even this was pretty heated. So the counter argument is why not fight for something bigger that will build more political support for the program? And that, in the end, is the best way to neutralize opponents, not a program that won't excite and mobilize the base. So I'm not dismissing the immense challenges in Congress, but I do think there are some political problems with this strategy.
Well, Margaret, that does sort of roll back the clock a bit, but is that something you think the White House is grappling with?
With whether they structured this the right way?
Whether they created a very complicated system.
No, I think that train like left the station about 3 years ago. I mean, I think with this White House and with this president, they're like, let's work with what's in front of us. And what's in front of them is basically something that they decided we will create a bulwark for the private insurance industry. We will beef up the way the private insurance industry works by giving them basically healthier risk pools. And in return, we will demand that they cover, you know, sick people who they don't want to cover now for stuff they don't want to cover now. So that was always like baked in the cake, right?
Right.
I mean, what Julian's talking about, it's true that it's a policy debate, but it's also true that it's the policy debate that they put to bed 3 years ago. I mean, this is the way it is. It's the way it's going to be. Now, the question is it going to work the way they said it's going to work, right? If what it means is that millions of people who couldn't get coverage for stuff they live with every day and had to, like, work for a big company in a job that they didn't really like so that they'd have insurance, like, does this change that? And if the kind of people that they're counting on to sign up right? Sign up in the right proportion. And if companies don't start looking for loopholes out of this, if it works the way it was sold, then it will change the face of how Americans are insured, even if it's doing so within kind of the existing rubric of the private insurance industry. The question is, and it's exacerbated by questions like, why, you know, we can't sign up, so why should we bother signing up, right? The question is, if they can't get this thing off the ground the right way and the right amount of young/healthy people don't sign up, does the whole thing collapse?
Well, and going back to you, Julian, then I do want to move on to some other things as well, but one of the things that the president and others have said, which is that basically this is a Republican idea that we have incorporated into the Affordable Care Act as a selling point, but that doesn't seem to have been a selling point for the Republican Party or members of the Republican Party.
No, and I think that's predictable. I think anyone in the White House understands that in the current administration, in the current political environment, facts don't always matter. And so you can't just put out an argument like that and expect Republicans to embrace it and expect Republicans to be neutralized by it. And so some Republicans have distanced themselves from the Massachusetts model. That's one response. And the others are just to ignore that and talk about what the administration's doing as their program. The reality is it is their program now. This is President Obama's program. And I think Margaret's right. The only real test now is whether this works or not. And the only way to neutralize the opposition from the perspective of the White House is to get people to buy into the program and to see the benefits. And that's the problem with the initial rollout. They're not seeing that. And it just gives Republicans more time to try to cause trouble.
But how do you make an argument for anything if Julian, facts don't matter?
Benefits matter. And I think, you know, you look at there's a poll out today how a lot of Americans support this proposed increase in the minimum wage, which is a very tangible benefit that I think people understand. And I think in an environment like this, the best bet of either side of the aisle is to actually deliver tangible benefits to Americans because they like that. Polls show again and again, Americans, even those ambivalent about government as an abstract idea, really like programs like Social Security and the minimum wage. And so that's why there's this urgency to deliver the benefits right now.
And Mark, we're almost up on a break here. Anything you want to add to what Julian just said?
I think word of mouth, particularly in the groups that they're trying to build on, young people, Latino community, is going to be huge in this effort. If young people and Latinos without insurance now are finding that once this is worked out, they can enroll and it is cheaper, affordable, and it does give them coverage, that is probably going to be more powerful than any, you know, PR program the government rolls out.
And that's Margaret Tolliff. She's White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Also with us, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. We are talking about the Obama administration, some of the problems that the president has been dealing with of late. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Door to Door Organics, an online grocer that delivers food fresh from organic farmers and local producers to homes throughout the Philadelphia metro area and beyond. More about food that supports health, community, and the environment at DoorToDoorOrganics.com.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Policy Studies that prepares students to take leadership roles in developing policies to address important issues impacting our communities. Students can choose from food and agriculture, sustainability and environment, or community and international development. More information about a Master of Arts in Policy Studies is available online at delval.edu/grad.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, new music by talented female vocalists from Yuna to Tiny Hearts. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. Supporting WHYY PNC Wealth Management. With over 160 years of experience, their team of financial professionals is committed to helping clients achieve their financial goals. More information is available from John Conaway at 215-585-5438.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, talking with Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, and Margaret Tolliff, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, talking about President Obama, some of the challenges that he has had this year, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Margaret, going back to you, President Obama apparently did not know that there were problems with the website. He also didn't know that the NSA was listening in on Angela Merkel's phone calls, if not listening in, certainly tracking those phone calls. Should we be surprised by that?
I'm not sure what the definition of didn't know really is. Let's talk about the NSA, because
okay.
I think they're two different issues. You know, the way that experts have explained this to us is that when a president gets intelligence, through his daily briefing or through whatever format, it may say something like, we have it from a very good source that when Merkel goes to Brussels, she may not wholeheartedly endorse XYZ.
Right.
And only if the president were to say, what's the very good source, might someone then tell him that the very good source was a conversation she had with her husband, like while going to pick up dinner. So, you know, I don't have the sense that the NSA was actively keeping things from the president, running some sort of shadow government, anything like that, right? I mean, our understanding in the way that this has been publicly explained thus far leaves a little bit of wiggle room. It is to say, we didn't fully sit the president down and say, hey, guess what? This is what we're doing, and here's her cell phone number, and we're listening to it. But they didn't tell him that they weren't doing it either, you know, and sometimes maybe it's a question of did he want to know? Did he think that he needed to know? That sort of thing. And also, you have to understand, because he has a BlackBerry, an iPad, and there's been a lot of internal discussion and controversy around that, around who he should contact, what he should say, should he even be carrying these devices, you know, when should he carry them, when should he not carry them. He knows that that's because his advisors are worried about him being surveilled. So it only follows that if other people are going to try to surveil him, maybe that's something the U.S. government is doing. So what did he really not know? And did he not know it because people, you know, were keeping secrets from him, they didn't want him to know, or because that's not the level at which presidents get read in?
Well, Julian,
there's a lot of wink, wink, nod, nod in the way this has been explained.
No, I hear you. And Julian, it does raise questions about, you know, what presidents know. I think there's this perhaps illusion that we think of presidents as being all powerful, you know, the most powerful man in the world, all knowing. But in reality, how does that flesh out?
Well, I think there's two parts to the answer. The first is presidents are not all-knowing, and whether you're talking about the specifics of a program and how it's working, RE, the healthcare, or if you're talking about surveillance and counterterrorism and national security, the reality is presidents are not always in the know. It's not just about power, which they don't have total power. They often are not in the loop of everything that's going on. But the second part is presidents authorize programs and accept programs where they know stuff is going on. And I think that's the question with the NSA. It's no mystery what the NSA has been doing, even if you're not in the White House. And the president certainly is cognizant of how this program has expanded under his watch. And here is someone who came to office as a critic of these programs. So it's a little hard to believe that he wouldn't be attuned to what's been going on under his administration, even if he didn't ask about certain details. So the question raises it raises questions about that decision rather than the specifics of which wiretap he knew about or didn't know about.
Well, and Clapper has said that we are doing essentially what we are doing is in the, quote, spirit and intent of the law. This gets into some sort of legalistic quagmire here. But it does, Julian, I guess, raise questions about what Congress authorized and how much authority the president has to run programs like this.
Yeah, and this is a question that dates back to President Bush's administration. It's the kind of question Democrats raised, not necessarily if something illegal happened or it's ethical even, but what exactly have we now authorized the executive branch of the NSA to do? And so, you know, this could also be an opportunity to review that. And it's not about dismantling the program, but trying to create certain kinds of checks and accountability mechanisms in a program which has immense power. And so I think that's where the debate really is at.
Margaret, there have been some articles recently, one in Vanity Fair, saying that Washington doesn't fear President Obama. I don't know how important that is. Do you think there's some truth to that?
It's true for every second-term president that your leverage is limited in the way that it wasn't in the first term. And it's also true that because President Obama has never had a particularly close or leveraged relationship with Congress, that it's hard to understand what he would take away, right? I mean, it's not like he's, you know, cutting deals left and right with his allies on the Hill. And so in that sense, it's like the old Kris Kristofferson song, right? Like, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Things are not particularly, they don't work that way anymore. And I'm not saying it's that Obama has, you know, failed to grab the brass ring on some old political trick, but it just, Washington doesn't really seem to work that way anymore. Like, it's harder for him, at least, maybe for any president, to make deals. And so it's like, what's the consequence? You know, we're going to stop getting invited to the White House to put our heads together on stuff. He runs a pretty tight ship. It's a pretty tight circle of advisors. You know, Hill leadership is often not brought in at all or brought in at the last minute. They feel sort of tertiary. So in that sense, I think that's true. But, you know, in a broader sense, especially when it comes to this NSA debate, you get a sense that a lot of what's going on in the Hill is for show also. So now the debate is, among other things, are they going to demand, insist upon confirmation for future NSA chiefs? And, okay, what's that going to do?
Right.
So they confirm him, and then they're going to stop tapping foreign leaders? I mean, what's the connect? What does it mean? Dianne Feinstein originally outraged about the, you know, Merkel disclosure, but even in her own release explaining what she supports, she left wiggle room to wiretap anybody if the situation required it. So it's very hard to understand how much of the outrage is really to press for fundamental change to this and how much of the outrage is to press to recast this politically.
Well, and that's sort of what Clapper was referring to, saying basically we're doing what Congress told us to do.
And what Congress knew we were doing, and if they didn't know it, they should have known it.
Interesting. I wonder, Julian, also whether, since we don't have the kind of earmarks that we used to have, whether that reduces a president or this president's power to navigate and negotiate and make deals. Do you think that has changed, or is that sort of just window dressing?
There's some of that. I mean, I do think there's a little nostalgia in general that we have about how easy earlier periods were. You can go into any period in American history, and almost inevitably you find frustration with Congress and a sense that nothing gets done in Washington. Really, the exceptions are when things get done. So I think we need to be careful. It's just different kinds of problems. And so the question is, what are the problems today, whether it's issues like earmarks or party polarization, and what is it going to take to change that? Presidents have limited power to really change the conditions in which they govern. It really rests on voters during elections and other external forces to change those dynamics, or the president will be in the same rut, whoever follows Obama.
But, Julian, when you hear people say, you know, this is the worst Congress ever, or this is the most dysfunctional Congress ever, you're saying, hold on, wait a minute?
Sure. You can go back to the 1950s and early 1960s and look at any newspaper and look at, you know, op-eds. You can read books from political scientists all talking about how Congress is broken, how it doesn't work, how it won't pass anything. Woodrow Wilson started his career as a political scientist in the 19th century writing about the same thing. This is an ongoing problem with the legislative branch. It's how it, in some ways, was designed this way. But we shouldn't assume that we're in the worst period ever just because that's what we're hearing, you know, from people in the thick of it.
What do you think, Margaret? You've been covering Washington for some time now?
Ask me after January 15th and the next CR, you know, next right. round with the continuing resolution and the next round with the debt limit. It does seem that this relatively recent trend of holding that up and drawing the markets into things has created a sort of new level of distraction that makes it really hard to bite off other stuff because the implications in theory are so big. Although in practice, the investors seem sort of like, oh yeah, yawn, yawn, here we go again. Right. So if that's the new normal, you know, maybe it isn't that big a deal. But that seems to me like a change and something different, although I don't have the same really deep knowledge of congressional history that Julian does, and I'm interested to hear what he thinks about this. But to my mind, what's been happening since 2011 does create sort of a new whirlpool inside the system.
Willing to play with the federal debt to get what you want.
It that seems new and different to me, and I don't know what compares historically in terms of sort of distractions that got people nervous in Congress.
And Julian, that does have worldwide implications. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean that is a kind of tool that I think the opposition is willing to use, which is dangerous, and it has huge consequences if the debt limit all of a sudden becomes a standard part of budget politics, which it is right now.
Right.
Obviously during the 1920s, as we veered into a depression, before 1932, there was a sense that Congress was just standing still and blocking everything as the nation disintegrated. In the 1960s. Civil rights, that the idea that Southerners would just hold bills up while people were dying in the streets was a similar sense of urgency and kind of, a horrendous reaction many people had to how Congress worked. So I think those are the kinds of problems I'm pointing to. But that said, it is fair to argue that, opponents can push things. And using the debt limit is not a good precedent because of the economic consequences it will have to just play with that as a budgetary tool.
Well, we're talking about our political system with Julian Zelizer, again, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author most recently of Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and Margaret Tolov, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. And we're curious about your perspective on our political system, how you think the president is doing, your perspective on Congress as well. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Julian, since you're over there in New Jersey, Chris Christie got reelected last week. No big surprise there. Do you see this as a sign that a conservative Republican can win in a blue state, or a sign that Chris Christie was able to win New Jersey?
Well, he is a conservative Republican. Conservatism means different things, but until Hurricane Sandy, he was pushing hard against the unions for pension reform, really going after the teachers and the domestic budget of the state. And he had, decent support. So I do think there's room for a certain kind of conservative to pull votes in these kinds of states. I think if they avoid the social and cultural issues and they avoid a total association with the Tea Party, they can pose a threat to Democrats, and Democrats need to take that seriously. Mm-hmm. I also think that nationally, a conservative of Christie's ilk can actually do well. And we shouldn't assume that in the primaries only a very far-right Republican is going to win this. So I think Christie comes out of this, as we think, very strong and certainly a potential threat to Democrats in 2016.
Well, Margaret, I know you're a White House correspondent, but I'd be curious about your perspective on Christie's win.
It's really interesting. I was on the road with President Obama last week. He was raising money in Texas for Democratic senatorial races, and one theme that he was sort of working on and developing in his fundraisers was the idea that while he supports the Democrats, while he is, his chief role is to champion Democrats, part of what he's trying to do is help moderate Republicans, which I think he'd put Christie in that camp, even though you can define anything any way you want.
Yeah, really.
But trying to help sort of centrist Republicans regain their own foothold, because, as he put it, it's really important to have a strong two-party system. And again, in his sort of terminology, to say that he doesn't think that's true of Republicans right now. Now, take that for what it's worth. Obviously, Obama doesn't want Republicans to, centrist Republicans to become so strong that they start beating Democrats in races. You know, he wants Democrats to dominate. But this idea that the system is so broken that Obama wants to empower centrist Republicans so that the U.S. can have actual, you know, debates where compromises get worked out was an interesting theme, and I don't know how real it is, how much is rhetoric and a fundraising tool, and how much is actually something that the White House thinks that they could have anything to do with and any actual impact on.
And, Julian, I'm always curious about how, you know, personality can sometimes trump politics. In the big scheme of things, a candidate's personality or an elected official's personality seems like it counts for a lot.
It certainly does count for a lot. And, you know, just informally, if you ask people what they think of a politician, it'll often come down to who they are, not necessarily what they stand for. So you have to be likable. You have to be an engaging personality, I think, to do well in the political process. We also have a very polarized electorate at this point. And so personality will only take you so far. The party system's pretty strong right now in the various states. So it's the balance the parties are trying to achieve. But Christie brings to the table a personality many people find engaging. And certainly in New Jersey, you can see the disconnect with where a lot of voters are with his policies and the fact they still vote for him. And I think personality is part of the explanation.
I mean, and fighter, I think, is one of the words in a positive way New Jersey voters have ascribed to Chris Christie, Julian.
Yeah, it's a fighter, you know, for his own policies, but also someone who just seems engaged in the political process. And in a kind of age when many people are cynical about what they're watching in Washington, there's something refreshing about that, whether it's, you know, staged and whether that's just part of a package voters are being sold, that's another issue. But I do think they like the idea of a fighter, someone who's even willing to fight their own party. Christie has done this now several times, and I think that's had it resonates with a lot of conservatives even who think the party needs to have a shakeup.
Margaret, about a minute before a second break here, but has the 2016 presidential campaign begun? I almost hate to ask that question.
Didn't it begin like a year ago?
Did it begin
Didn't
a
it?
Year ago?
Didn't it, right?
Am I late? I'm late to the party here?
it has, it's like flirting and warming up and winking.
Okay.
And looking cute, but it hasn't put on its heels and its fancy dress yet. You'll know when it does. I mean, but it's getting there. It's starting to.
And are we going to see Ted Cruz in heels? Is that what you're saying, Margaret Thomas?
Oh, I'll let you say that, Marty. I wouldn't say that. But I would watch that. Things are heating up, and you see it, and you saw the kind of beginnings of it on the Republican side with the debt ceiling debate and the CR debate, and you're seeing it now on the Democratic side in terms of why aren't we hearing more from Joe Biden,
right,
and what's Hillary doing,
right,
and what's Bill doing, and
right,
who's campaigning for whom in Virginia. But again, this is the warm-up. You can expect in the next couple of months to see a market uptick of the pace on both sides.
And that's Margaret Tolliv, also with us, Julian Zelizer. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about politics, presidential politics, President Obama. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Ali Brosh talks about her autobiographical blog, Hyperbole and a Half. She describes it as stand-up comedy with drawings. But her most popular posts were about the depression that left her emotionally numb.
I would sort of have to consciously control my facial expressions because I wasn't feeling enough organic emotion to generate them naturally.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
the waiting after Typhoon Haiyan.
I think the scariest thing was really the last time we did hear from them, my uncle's house was completely gone. Completely blown away.
Philippine Americans holding out hope and waiting for word. Grief and worry along the Pacific Rim. The latest on the destruction and heartache in the Philippines. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. So what do you want the President and Congress to do? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, Margaret Tolov, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, is our guest, along with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Margaret, let me go back to you and actually talk about an issue, which is immigration reform. President Obama says that he wants to get reform passed sometime, if not this year, sometime in the near future. What do you think the chances for that is?
I think it's entirely possible that some element of immigration reform may be passed between now and the end of his presidency, but whether it is going to be the path to citizenship for 11 million people that they're not calling amnesty unless you're against it and then you call it amnesty is still in question. And to me, one big question has always been this issue of the Dream Act and what you do with the children of people who came here without documentation and brought their children here as minors. Now, the Democrats' position on this has been that they don't want to just break off a piece of this, and the Republicans' position on this has been that they're not haven't been ready to move fully on it yet. Anyway, but it's just obvious that that would be one compromise that both sides would get something meaningful out of. The question is whether there's a consensus to go for that smaller, that smaller deal, or whether to hold out for the big one.
Well, Julian, President Bush, after he was reelected, tried to get some traction on immigration reform, and he was unable to do that. Why do you think this issue is so tough?
Look, the Republicans have been very divided on this. President Bush didn't just put this as one issue. It was really a central issue to him. It was something he cared about a lot since his days in Texas. And he could get nowhere because there is a hardline element in the Republican Party that has, you know, been staunch in its opposition to a path to citizenship. The other issues, there's some wiggle room, but that's one where there hasn't been. And so President Obama has faced an immense challenge on Capitol Hill because, you know, if President Bush couldn't do it, the chances of him turning the Republicans were very limited. And thus far, you know, business groups, religious groups, all of which have been lobbying, have been unable to switch the vote in these districts. So I think this is one of the huge issues that there's going to be a lot of regret for the president if he can't move it. And the compromise would be good, but I think the path to citizenship is really the immigration reform that matters most in terms of his legacy and in terms certainly of what the president is hoping for. And I don't know if that's going to happen.
But what's interesting, Julian, is when you go back to Ronald Reagan, what he got passed when he was president would probably be considered, you know, amnesty to today's critics of immigration reform.
Absolutely. And the critics are a faction that they were still there in the 1980s. They were part of the Republican Party. There were elements in the Democratic Party, though those have really faded. But the difference was there was just a bigger part of the Republican Party, including the president in 1986, which was not on the same page as the restrictionists. But the politics has changed in part of the GOP. And
that's right.
We've seen a shift to the right. They've shifted right. And I think they've left some Republicans, certainly in the Senate, behind.
Margaret, go ahead.
When you look at the group that the president had over to the White House, you know, last week, the sort of corporate interests, everything from investment sector to Marriott and McDonald's, that used to see what interest various sectors of American business has in getting investor visas, tech visas, or just cheap labor, right? And these are business interests, but they're not business interests that are getting very much traction from the party that had for years aligned itself as the party of, you know, of business and corporate America. So the president, you know, now trying to, he's not been great at working with business on issues. It's not, you know, if you ask the Chamber of Commerce, they've not always been in lockstep, certainly, but this is something that he's looking for, to say, what can I do with business to try to do a more successful lobbying job on that aspect of immigration reform? And business is saying, we welcome it, we're really glad we got invited, but how do you translate that into action? Right. Not clear if they can't budge the Republican Party.
Well, and are we talking about the Tea Party faction of the Republican Party, Margaret, that the more conservative or even extreme conservative of the party?
The issue still comes down to what it came down to during the budget debate and during the upcoming budget debate that we'll have again, which is House leadership has the ability to bring votes to the floor in a different way. Is that something that John Boehner is willing to do, or will he continue to insist on essentially, you know, the full support of the caucus to not leave out any faction? It's not like a faction of 30 or 40 House members has the inherent ability to block anything from getting to the House floor. That's happening because of a decision by the Speaker. And for Boehner, immigration has always been something that has been a legacy goal of his as well. The question is just, between now and the end of the Obama presidency, is the Speaker going to stake his own leadership position on that? What will he do? And it's not yet clear that he will do anything.
Is that significant, Julian?
Yeah, I think it's significant. I think, you know, what you're seeing is this really a significant fight in the Republican Party on this issue, because it has enormous electoral consequences. And I think that's really what a lot of people in the GOP are thinking about, and the president has been watching to see how this plays out. But many Republicans are not simply pro-immigration. They are terrified of losing the immigrant vote for decades to come. They're looking at states like Texas and saying, you know, if these go Democratic because we are the opponents, because John Boehner won't allow something to happen, because there's a faction of the party that won't allow something to happen, you know, the immigrant vote, which is huge, can go to Democrats and help to create a coalition that outlasts President Obama. And he might lose on the issue, on the policy, but the Democrats might win in the long run. And I think there's frustration. There's a lot of Republicans, conservative business leaders, evangelicals, who, for a combination of believing in liberalized immigration but also seeing the electoral map, don't understand why this small group of House Republicans is holding this up or can hold this up. And I think it could be a critical moment in that way for the next few election cycles.
Well, let me throw something else out that I also came up earlier this year, which was trying to get support for gun registration after the horrible shootings at Newtown, Connecticut, Margaret. And there was huge support for this idea. Even members of the NRA were in support of the idea, and yet it couldn't get through Congress.
No, and nothing is poised to change. That is, like, on the list of things that are going to happen early next year or in the middle of next year or late last year, next year. It's just that if they were not able, the advocates, including the president, realized that last year was their window for a big push, period. And as the president goes forward, these are some of the numbers to look at. For the second-term president, Gallup, 40% approve, 54% disapprove. Pew, 41% approval, 53% disapproval. NBC, Wall Street Journal, 42% approve, 51% disapprove. This is what the president's up against right now because of what have you, because of health care, because of NSA, because of just, you know, malaise. Right? This is what he's dealing with. So his power of the pulpit is compromised right now by his position in the eyes of the average American.
What do you think, Julian, when a president's numbers are that low?
Yeah, I mean, look, second terms are not fun. And this is a common pattern, as you started the show by saying. There's all kinds of reasons, but second terms are never easy. And he hasn't had some of the success that second term presidents like a Reagan had in in obtaining a few more measures that helped define his presidency. And now sometimes he must feel like George W. Bush, seeing approval ratings that are far lower than he thinks are right, and feeling that he just can't move the political system anymore. And, you know, I think one of the great frustrations of a second-term president is they watch the clock tick down. So, you know, part of the whole issue with the website of ACA and the budget battles that came before that was he saw immigration reform kept getting pushed back further and further, and he realizes that time's limited. Now the midterms begin, and then the presidential election begins, and Republicans are not going to compromise with a president whose approval ratings are this low because they just want to add to the story. So I think there is a great frustration in the White House, and it becomes harder every month for him to get something big.
But of course, Julian, the approval ratings for Congress are even worse. Now, Congress is a body; the president is a person. Does that mean that Congress is equally not in trouble, but struggling?
Well, they are. I think what matters more are rates of incumbency. That's what members care about. So, sure, if national polls of Congress are terrible, they get worried. The majority party certainly gets nervous that there's going to be a flip in the midterm elections. But many members just look at their seats, and they're not so concerned. And so those polls don't bother them as much. And they're willing to just hold their ground and make sure, certainly in their districts, that they're just reelected and avoid any kind of primary challenge. So I think the national polls are different for the two institutions.
Margaret, I noticed that the president has been using, I guess, executive orders as one way to get around Congress. Has that been effective for him?
It is effective compared to nothing.
Compared
to- and he will continue to look for ways to do that. When it comes to environmental regulation specifically, when it comes to some of the implementation, continued implementation of healthcare, and certainly when it comes to carving out his executive power in terms of what it can do on surveillance, what he's going to be doing on national security policy. This is a tool that all presidents seek to use, and this is a tool that the president is very much seeking to use, even as he talks about publicly about transparency or about ending a perpetual war, et cetera, when Congress, when you don't control, when your party doesn't control Congress, when it's split and when it's dysfunctional, you'd be crazy not to look at using executive power, and that's precisely what he's looking to do. But even so, that this is largely a matter of holding the line, and only somewhat a matter of really trying to being able to shape too much more of a legacy. I think while he is going to look to executive power to try to shape especially more of an environmental legacy and a national security legacy, he's also looking at that healthcare as his best chance of salvation. Even though it looks messed up right now, I think his administration is very much dedicated to the notion that if they can fix this and pull it off and kind of get past this bad patch now, if they can make it do what they think it can do, then that is how he can be remembered domestically in terms of in the history books.
And Margaret, I don't know, you know, where these people are that are working on the Gov site, but I'm assuming this is a 24/7 operation.
Right, they're in a bunker in Nebraska somewhere. You know, Jeff Zients has been is now the new face of this effort, but it is not just people at HHS and contractors. It's the insurance companies themselves talking to the administration, saying, "Hey, what can we do? Because we want you to get this right too, because we're the ones who have to deal with it." It is a huge, vast 24/7 effort.
Julie,
it's not clear how well organized it is,
but there are a lot of people that are I guess trying to figure out how to obviously get it up and running. Let me ask you, Julian, about John Runyon, again, going back to New Jersey, quitting Congress after 4 years, two terms in Congress, made that announcement recently, and it seems as if he was expressing some degree of frustration with how Congress works.
Yeah, I think Runyon's comments are not dissimilar to other resignations that we've seen. Recently with people frustrated about their party, frustrated with the fundraising, frustrated with the paralysis in Washington. And so you see retirements. I think some are genuine. Some are clearly people who get into this, stay a few years, and really don't see – the benefits of continuing in that process. Others have other reasons, and they use this as a way to legitimate their decision to step down. Runyon is not alone, and you know that's the unfortunate part when you lose people because the process is broken, rather than because they lose in an election or because you know they've been in so long.
Margaret, you get a close-up view of the president. Has he? I mean, he looks older. He is older, and do you think he's beginning to show some of the wear and tear of the office?
I do, but not in a shocking or surprising way. I think, ironically, because I know he wanted to change the country and then change the world, he's very much experiencing what presidents experience, which is like a second term's hard. Congress is divided. The economy's been in a slump. You know, these are hard issues, and you know, on the terrorism front. I mean, people are not going to love it when you're spying on them. They're doing it because they think they have to, you know. On the healthcare front, even though the administration made a lot of the tactical mistakes that contributed to the startup of this, it's like really hard to start up a website and insure millions of Americans. A lot of these are just bad things that happen because what they're trying to do is complicated. Mm-hmm. And this is the time in a two-term presidency when you slog through it. His foreign policy is stagnant and a mess. His domestic policy is totally kneecapped by the divisions in Congress. It's hard stuff. And, and he's showing some of the wear and tear of that.
Well, my thanks to both of you, as always, for joining us today in Radio Times. Margaret Talla, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And she's White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Julian Zelizer, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, joined us from their studios. Also the author of a book called Governing America, The Revival of Political History. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.